Okay, I want to thank you all for coming and listening and helping me understand what's really understood and not understood about this subject, and I certainly enjoyed myself. This is the record for the most shown movie of the conference, which I, you know.
We should remake this movie.
Yeah, I'm sort of worried about it. I'm sort of, you know, this movie could be made with infinitely better quality these days, so I don't know why we're all showing a movie from the 50s.
Well, it may not have ever happened again.
But isn't it beautiful? I mean, isn't it wonderful that we show a movie of a person that, you know, is not even around anymore?
Right. Now, this is the record for the least shown movie, but I think there is a point here, which is, you know, every time we keep seeing movies of two-dimensional cells turning and doing other things, this is a movie that from David Saul, who has, you know, worked on Dicty, showing very high-quality 3D reconstructions of cells, and I think I wanted to make the point that, you know, as much as we're trying to understand polarity and motion, I think we can be here 25 years from now and we'll still be working on the issue of really understanding cell shape and how that's controlled by these systems. That's really the problem of the, you know, of the next couple of decades, is to really integrate our understanding of the signaling pathways, which I hope we're making some progress on, with then control of the cytoskeleton, adhesion, membrane dynamics and all that, to really be able to understand how the cells physically move. And that's we're a long way off from that, but that's sort of the...
But actually, already, that was a neutrophil, right?
That was Dicty.
The Saul movie was a Dicty.
Yes. Yeah, that was Dicty. One thing that I think came across very clearly in some of the talks and discussions, which I just wanted to highlight it, is that there are really two different phenomena that coexist and interact with each other. There's a gradient sensing part, which is a response to an external stimulus where the cell is able to figure out which way to go based on external information. Then there's polarity, which is sort of a memory inherent in the cell of which way it's moving currently, and these things interact with each other. So a small gradient will stabilize the polarity so that a cell which is polarized and a small gradient clearly will maintain that polarization and continue moving for a long time. Polarization will have some persistence even in the absence of a stable gradient, and I think it might be different depending on which cell types we're talking about, exactly how long that persistence is. Cells that have no polarity, which admittedly seem easier to obtain in endothelium than in neutrophils, and I don't think I don't know what the answer is for fibroblasts, but cells that have no polarity, of course, are in some sense waiting to be told by the gradient sensing mechanism which way they should be developing their polarity. So there's these two things that coexist, and one has to just be careful exactly what the experiments are and what type of cells one's looking at. One very important issue which I'm interested in about gradient sensing versus polarity is where exactly is the role of feedback from the cytoskeleton. We've seen a lot of pictures of cells that have been treated by Latrunculin to somehow eliminate the actin polymerization, and exactly how that changes what's going on. And I think, you know, one doesn't really know, but there's a possibility at least that for initial sensing, for the gradient sensing probably, at least in some cases, this feedback is less important, whereas polarity clearly is crucial. And so I think that's all has to all be thought out and sort of disentangled. And of course, once you have polarity, if you give it a new gradient sensing, if you try to reverse the direction, then of course the question is, how is the current decision, the current polarity, undone? And we saw examples that depending on the strength of the gradient cell, again depending on what cell type we're talking about, it can happen in a variety of ways. The cell can turn, or if you really force it, the cell can reorganize completely, and exactly understanding how that works, I think, will help unravel this distinction between those things that many speakers focused on. Clearly, cells have multiple pathways, and that makes life hard for a number of reasons. The first thing, the first reason it makes it hard is that, you know, we all would like to interpret phenotypes in a simple way. We all like to say, if you knock out something, you know, P10 or something else, then that obviously has this phenotype, and therefore it obviously does this. And it's just not that simple. Those of us, you know, as cell biology improves and people learn about more and more signaling transduction pathways, the getting from individual molecules to the systems level phenotype is just going to be hard, because it's going to require, because cells really have multiple pathways, sometimes redundant. Different cell types may use a different mix of these paths. And I think I was certainly interested in Rick Vertel mentioning that there were other cells that, in fact, we weren't really even talking about here that seemed to use even different types of pathways than the ones. I mean, part of the reason that brings everybody here is that, at least at some level, there are similarities in what seems to be going on in Dicti and neutrophils and fibroblasts, but perhaps there are other cells where the similarities are further away, and we have to work harder to try to really hear about other cell types. So that's something which I personally didn't quite appreciate before listening to, for example, Rick Vertel's talk. Okay. Now, this one I really like. You know, so there's a famous poem about blind men looking for the elephant. And I didn't copy the entire poem, but the basic idea is the blind man feels the trunk and thinks an elephant is like a snake. The blind man feels the feet, a different blind man feels the feet and thinks that the elephant is like a tree. And you go through six blind men, and then the end of the poem is, so often theologic wars, disputants I lean, rail on in utter ignorance of what each other mean, and prayed about an elephant that not one of them has seen. So, you know, I think that could be described, the signaling pathways could be described with the same metaphor. Certainly the modeling is sort of interesting that, you know, those of us who thought about modeling have focused, just because of our own interests or whatever, on different aspects. And, you know, it's not exactly clear at the moment, you know. So Pablo, I think, is focused on adaptation and, you know, in terms of a sort of perfect adaptation or near perfect adaptation mechanisms. The talk by Atul Narang focused mostly on like what I call the physics of symmetry breaking, which is how positive feedback can give an organization of the cell, even, for example, in the absence of an external stimulus, something like the polarization response, backness versus frontness, in Henry Warren's language. We've, of course, the work I've done with Walter is focused more on the response kinetics and exactly what happens sort of very quickly. And, you know, maybe at some point in the next few years, as the data becomes more clear about what really is being seen, perhaps there needs to be some integration of these individual pieces into an entire elephant. But that certainly is not there yet. At the experimental end, what did I hear about? Everhard's been telling me for at least a few years that optical effects need to be disentangled from precise concentration effects. And I think for the first time we saw an experiment, at least certainly I saw for the first time in the experiment with Tobias Meyer, where he had tried to do that in a careful way and had come to the conclusion that the glass is half full. Which means that about half of what he saw could be attributed to artifacts and focus. He interpreted to membrane ruffles, but it equally well could be focusing. He had no, you know, it didn't really matter what the mechanism was, but about half of what he saw seemed to be artifacts, not artifacts from the cell's point of view, they're real changes in the cell, but not concentration effects of translocation to the membrane. On the other half, of what he saw seemed to be really translocation events. So the glass is really half full, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it, but I think that pointed out that one could really do a better job. Can the promise of microfluidics, Meyer's normalization procedure somehow should have been the previous one. That got messed up, never mind. So that should have been Meyer's normalization procedure, should be on top of, can the promise of microfluidics be realized? Good question. I certainly hope so. It's certainly why many people are working on it, because there is a huge promise there. And then, you know, we didn't hear very much about trying to make quantitative measurements of biochemical kinetics. But of course, to the extent that one would like to ground models in real molecular details, as opposed to just guesses, it would really help if some of these positive feedback loops that one is beginning to see based on, for example, genetic methods or other methods really could somehow be quantified. You know, what is really, you know, how positive is it? Does it really depend on, I don't know, square concentrations because of dimerization or some higher order cooperativity or whatever? That somehow, we didn't hear much about that because it's very hard, but if we really want to bring models down to the molecular scale, that someone's, we're going to need some help doing that. Sociological challenges. Well, okay. So there are many of those. Perhaps the biggest sociological challenge, which you can argue, you know, maybe we should take a vote afterwards, is there's still a lot of convincing of biologists that modeling has something to offer.
What about convincing modelers that biology is something dumb?
Well, so, you know, well, so that's the second point on my list. The second point on my list is sort of the converse, which is that, you know, physicists, or modelers more generally, when they try to make models, of course, you know, we're not going to make a simulation in which every molecule in the cell is tracked by a molecular dynamics. I mean, they're not going to do that. And even one level above that, we're not going to make a simulation where every single detailed molecular interaction that is relevant for acting is going to be included precisely. First of all, we'd have to wait for 100 years to know anything precise to be able to do that in an ab initio way. And it's just, you know, at some point you say, why are you even bothering if all you're doing is creating, you know, a computer equivalent of the cell that you can't even think about other than by running the simulation? Why not just do the experiment? So the point of modeling is to try to use models to figure out which details matter, which matter less, what are possible mechanisms, what are new experiments that could distinguish different mechanisms. So, but on the other hand, you know, if you're trying to figure out what details matter and what's really going on, you better know about all the details before you throw out some of them as not being important. So you can't just get, you know, so biologists have to be convinced the modeling is something to offer, and modelers have to be convinced that the details are something you need to know about in order to be serious about modeling. Different theories really do predict different responses. I mean, it's easy to say, oh, gee, you know, everybody up here presented a reaction diffusion type theory with inhibitors, and therefore they're all saying the same thing. In fact, there are many differences among even, you know, among the types of things people looked at with these existing theories. For example, what is the inhibitor? You heard several suggestions about possible different types of inhibitors. You know, those can be tested. Which positive feedback is necessary for what? We heard several possible positive feedback schemes, and exactly which of those is important is a makes a difference. We heard about timing of responses, and we saw attempts to move towards experimental tests of some of those in Chris's talk. And so this is still a challenge, trying to get everybody from different directions to sort of work together. Hopefully meetings like this will help to at least sort of see where we are, and therefore I thank you all for coming. And that's all I did, all I prepared. Yes, Robert.
Actually, I would also, we should really thank you and also the organizers of this program. Yes. At the ITP, because if they wouldn't have organized the program, we wouldn't, yes, be here, and we wouldn't have another conference. So I would like to thank everybody. I think it was an extremely stimulating meeting, and I hope we all meet again and have more to say, right? And so,
okay.
I just wanted to say that.
Questions? Well, I don't have any questions. But,
well, I thought there's a question.
Yes.
So the good fairy comes to you.
The good fairy comes to
me. What are you going to ask?
What?
Which one of them
do
you
ask? Which question do you think is the most important question?
I think that's in the...
Not necessarily an easy question.
Which question is the most important?
You're given one
fairy.
You're given
one question to ask of the fairy.
Yeah.
At the moment, for my personal interest, what, yes, I would ask the fairy?
Yes.
Which is the positive feedback that really controls the self-organization? That to me is the question which we don't know the answer to.
Okay,
that's my fairy question.
That controls the
ability of the cell to take the gradient that's
and make polar
and polarize. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's polarized in my sense is really about what Henry said, frontness, backness, and maybe middleness. And that clearly has a memory, and therefore there's some notion of a switch or bistability or something, whatever the language we want to use, but there's clearly a memory involved in that. It clearly can be switched by a strong enough external contradictory signal, as shown, for example, in the simulation by Atul, in his model of that. And the really interesting question from the biochemical kinetic perspective to me is, where in all these pathways, which is really maybe it's different for different cell types. I mean, that's a possibility. Where is the positive feedback that really matters for that? So that's what I would ask the fairy.
And don't you think it's likely that, in fact, there are several that matter?
Right.
I think one of the rules of our biology is it never uses one way of doing anything,
right,
because the redundancy...
Right, and furthermore, I would say that the mix of what matters could be different in different cell types. That's one of the things I said. So maybe, right, so, but that to me is, you know, from a point of view of physics modeling, I think that to me is the, you know, very important question that I don't know the answer to, so I can't know where to put it in my thinking. Maybe other people have different questions they would ask the fairy. I would submit to one of the experimentalists. Let's see, they, you know, what would their answer to be to this question be? Good question, Louis. So now we can put someone else on the spot.
Well, I mean, this is one of those wonderful questions you ask when you only have one question, which is, what are all the details that are needed to be understood?
Yeah, that's too many questions. That's like saying the first wish is to get 1,000 wishes. You know, that's unfair.
But I think it's a terribly important aspect. How do you know when you have enough of the details?
Okay. Okay, that's fine.
How do you know when you have enough of the details to warrant modeling? And
no, you see, but I think that's the wrong way to think about it, Bill. It's not that you have enough of the details to warrant modeling, because if you have enough of the details, modeling is not important. It's only, you know, modeling is supposed to be a way to try to help you design experiments and ways of thinking about the system that will help focus your attention on what those details are. It's not that you get all the details, you work for 50 years in the bio lab, and then suddenly the bell rings and you say, aha, I know enough, and now I go and make the model. We've had this discussion many times, but I don't think that's the right way to think about what modeling is.
So you're saying that modeling is always premature.
Yes.
And therefore,
modeling to be interesting is always premature.
And that you will have many different models, and new facts will come in, and various ones will drop
And various ones will be synergistically combined, and you'll work collectively towards an integrated view of how it works. That's the role of modeling, not the collect all the pieces and put it together to have a more quantitative realization of what we already understand qualitatively. That's not as interesting to at least those of us who do modeling.
But isn't the criterion of a model that is worthwhile one that proposes an experiment that you didn't think of otherwise?
Yes, that's one of
them. So you come right down to it.
And that's certainly one of the main important criteria of a model is that it proposes that certain experiments can really be crucial in unraveling what's going on. And that sometimes you need a model. It may be you can do that with what we physicists somehow denigrate and call cartoon-like models. But biologists all the time use models, which are non-mathematical, in what?
We call this phenomenological model.
No, we don't call it phenomenological model. We call it what you get when you open up Albert's book. So when you open up Albert's book, there's a model for everything. It's just always in a picture. You want to look at the actin myosin contraction, you know, there's a picture of the cycle and the thing with the lever arm does this. If you want to look at, you know, I don't know, exocytosis, there's a picture of the vesicle and it pinches off and does this. So those are models too. It's just that, those give you some guidance, which you all biologists use, got models at that level, to guide what experiments they're going to be doing and what questions they're going to answer. So as we get into more complicated and more quantitative experiments and more complicated issues, those pictures are not powerful, at least those of us who thought about it, are not powerful enough to really be good enough to help you guide those experiments. So therefore, one just has to take those pictures and be more precise about what the predictions are based on those pictures. And that's how we view the role of the models. We don't view it as we're going to solve the problem for you. The problem is real, you know, is really what a cell does, not what we think a cell should do. But models are more than just collecting all the pieces and putting them together after that's understood.
But you know, there's a notion of a phenomenological model. So for example, you know, your Meinhard model will say that there is some short-range positive feedback activator, and there is a longer range inhibition, and that may very well describe phenomenological behavior of the cell, and you don't really need to know what exactly is the molecule that is mediating the inhibition, and whether there is one or three. All you need to know is some strength of the inhibition and the range of the inhibition. Right. And that sort of a model can help you organize, we'll make predictions, we'll help with design experiments, but is really quite a different story than the molecular scale model.
The trouble is that I think that modeling like that, unless you know what the inhibitor is, you're not going to get very long.
And the counterexample to that is the model of Lewis Wolpert, who postulated that positional value still has no idea what the.
That's right. He's not inhibited.
Never be inhibited by lack of facts, right?
That's the Wolpert dictum. No. Right? Don't let the facts get in the way.
The absence there.
You know, I think there's a lesson to be learned. You know, many of us who work on biological systems used to have a life working on non-biological systems, and I think people have an incorrect notion about modeling a physical and chemical system. So let's take, for example, the Belozov-Shabotinsky reaction that was mentioned by a few people, because you know, when you see spiral waves in dictyostelium, many of us, you know, started out by thinking about it as a living example of the same type of waves you see in Belozov-Shabotinsky. If you go and ask a chemist, what are the detailed kinetics of the Belozov-Shabotinsky reaction, because you want to make a model which could predict what happens when you dump in, you know, 20% of some chemical, then you discover that there are 25 species and lots of intermediates, and you don't know the kinetics. And you can't do that. I mean, you can guess, you can get some idea, but you can't make an ab initio model of the Belozov-Shabotinsky reaction that has all the species in it and can give you the ability to make a prediction of what happens when I dump in some particular chemical, what's going to happen. On the other hand, I would maintain that we have a great deal of understanding of the mechanisms in the Belozov-Shabotinsky reaction. We understand the waves. We understand how the waves change qualitatively as you change various parameters. We understand why in some regimes you get chaotic oscillations and in some regimes you don't. There's a whole list of things that we understand about the mechanisms in the Belozov-Shabotinsky reaction that are done with an increasingly, you know, simple models, more sophisticated models, working towards more realistic kinetic models. So modeling is not a point, you know, it's not either Gehr or Meinhardt or a model in which you have everything else. So Belozov-Shabotinsky, it's not either a simple, you know, equation or the one that has 25. There's a continual evolution depending on what questions you're asking, whether those questions are addressable in the simplest generic type of models of like Gehr or Meinhardt would be for this case, there is some other model, or whether you really want to go to have all the molecules. So it sort of depends on what the question you're answering. If you want to know what the inhibitor really is, you better make, you know, then your model better have a chemical for what the inhibitor really is. If you want to know what the range of the inhibitor is because of some control in the cell, you actually don't care if it's as long as you know its diffusion constant. So if you know its diffusion constant is characteristic of a small protein, that may be enough information to go and make certain predictions. So it's not a point. It's not a point on a. It's really a range depending on what questions you're trying to address.
I mean, there is. Very good evidence that what you're saying is not correct for physical systems. There isn't very good evidence that it isn't correct for biological systems. But the best evidence is that the equations for the flow of champagne and the flow of urine are the same. And they really are.
What about a mixture of champagne and urine?
What about the fact
you
that
don't you need to know? You don't. You don't need to know about the details. You don't need to know how it flows.
Well, that's a good note. I'm